This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. If you read The New Yorker, it's pretty much a cinch that the first thing you do is look for the cartoons, and it's a pretty safe bet that you have some favorites, cartoons that you describe to someone, and you get a laugh. And I'd be willing to wager that there are New Yorker cartoons taped to refrigerators and thumbtacked to company bulletin boards in every city, town, and village in the U.S. Cartoons drawn by Peter Arno, James Thurber, Charles Adams, George Booth, Roz Chast, Bob Mankoff, and many others. And now, a cheer should go up here. Great news for fans of The New Yorker and its cartoons. The magazine's 75th anniversary cartoon collection is in bookstores. And now, another cheer, I think, because this afternoon it is our great pleasure to talk with one of The New Yorker's talented group of cartoonists. Our guest is Bob Mankoff. His drawings have appeared in the magazine since 1977. In addition to being a cartoonist, he's also the magazine's cartoon editor, and he edited the magazine's 75th anniversary cartoon collection. Mankoff's style is cartoon pointillism, and as I said a year ago when he was on the show, his humor is as sharp as the nib of the pen he uses to make his points. A couple in the living room. He's on the phone, crouched down on the floor under the arm of the sofa. He's got a gun. She's at the other end of the sofa. She has a gun, too, and she's firing at him. She's missed. She's missed him, but the lamp is a goner. So what is he telling the person at the other end of the line? As a matter of fact, you did catch us at a bad time. Or this, which is tacked above the phone on my desk here at WILL. A businessman on the telephone, standing over his appointment book, says to the person at the other end of the line, "Nope, Thursday's out." How about never? Is never good for you? Questions and comments for our guests this afternoon are welcome. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else in Illinois or Indiana, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. Bob Mankoff, good afternoon. Welcome back.
Celeste, you know, the way you presented those cartoons, I'm thinking, you know, I definitely want you doing that for all my cartoons.
Oh, that is...
You do it much better than I do.
Oh, I don't know about that, but thanks. That's a great compliment.
Well, I think one of the powers of the cartoons when they're done right is that they're strong enough sort of as, you know, what I call these sort of cognitive humor vehicles that they translate, they work.
Yeah.
They work as jokes, as you know, when you describe them.
Yeah. Well, that's what I love about. I love telling cartoons because, you know, well, you should get the credit, but I get the laugh.
And so, could you send a small check my way every time you do that?
I should. Do you recall your first encounter with New Yorker cartoons?
I think that I as a kid, I looked probably in doctor's offices at cartoons, not only the New Yorker, but on Saturday Evening Post as well. And I think my first real encounter with New Yorker cartoons when I was a big sports fan, and when Bill Bradley, now a candidate, was playing basketball for Princeton, there was this very, very long article in the New Yorker called A Sense of Who You Are. It went on for 65 pages on Bill Bradley, and I was a big sports fan, and I sort of almost started reading this as a sports article, and along the way I noticed there were all these cartoons as well.
Mm. Your work has been published in the magazine since 1977. What was the first cartoon that...
The first cartoon, I left, I was in graduate school, I was a student in experimental psychology, and just about to get my dissertation when, this is true, my experimental animal died, a pigeon. I took this as an omen. I quit. I was very much influenced by Saul Steinberg in my early cartoons. Mm-hmm. My later cartoons, as you've sort of enunciated them, are, you know, very much these sort of verbal one-liners, mostly. The first cartoon I did, it's very hard to describe. It has it's a big printing press, like an old-fashioned one that newspapers used to come out of, and a big newspapers, you know, coming off the presses. At the end of the press, there's a guy eating breakfast, and he's picking up the end of the newspaper and reading it, and there's two eggs and a glass of orange juice next to him. So that was the very first one, and I probably had submitted about 300 cartoons to the New Yorker before they bought that one.
Well, you began cartooning, you say, in the womb.
Well, that's, of course, a lot. What we call a soundbite, as you're well familiar.
Yeah,
but in a metaphorical sense, very early on was drawing cartoons and making jokes and often trying to draw and make jokes and combine the two. In fact, one of the very first cartoons I ever found that I did was when I was 7 or 8. Recently, I was at my mom's house, and I live in up in Westchester. My mom's in Queens, New York, and she's in her 90s now. And I was, rummaging through one of these closets, and I came on these old drawings of mine from when I was just a kid. And it was interesting. The cartoon probably was done, in the late 50s when I was just a kid, and it has a robot.
Because
I think I probably had toys like Robbie the Robot.
Sure.
And there's a robot in the middle where his lights, it's saying tilt. And he's running he's trying to kill somebody with like an iron hammer. But in looking back at it, I realized, that's basically it in some sense. Do you know what I mean? It's the combination of an idea and a drawing that all of a sudden the viewer processes. And in that single moment, it's a joke. It's an idea.
Yeah. Tilt.
Tilt. like a pinball machine.
Yeah, right. I suppose, though, there are folks who may be listening who don't know what a pinball machine is. Although I think...
Oh, pity them. Pity them.
Yeah.
Just go up to www.pinball.com. where all and everything will now be explained to everyone on the Internet.
Yeah. Well, what's the process of cartooning like? You have to have that... You have to have the drawing, generally, you need some copy. You need a caption.
Well,
generally, not always.
In a more organic way,
yeah.
You might be. Well, for any professional cartoonist, and this book, the 75th anniversary, which it has, 707 cartoons, out of which the New Yorker published 60,000, and I picked 700 for inclusion in the book. Every artist in this book, on Tuesday I see 1,000 cartoons. Every artist who's a professional for the New Yorker will do 10 or 20 ideas a week. So it's not really this sort of, as people imagine it, this thing of coming up with a single idea. I mean, I was once at my cardiologist because I had an arrhythmia, and he's trying to make me feel calm and saying, so what do you do? And I said, well, I'm a cartoonist for the New Yorker. And he said, oh, great, I have an idea for a cartoon. I said, great, I've got an idea for a biped. Everybody's got an idea. It's more the process. As a professional, you sit down. You might sit down through the newspaper. You might sit down with other drawings. And then, you work for a number of hours until half things come to you, three quarters, then they combine, then you get an idea and you move to the next one. So for the person who's doing it in the midst of it, it's hard to break it out.
Yeah, yeah. I would imagine there are tilt moments, though, I don't know. What does it feel like?
Well, there's
like
some moments where you get the idea sometimes, with like an aha experience.
Uh-huh.
Often when you're starting out, but often later it's not quite like that. You don't. You're in the process of you're getting up in the morning. You're having your cup of coffee. You're reading the paper. You're starting to doodle your sketch. You might have copied down a phrase that you heard, like "Let's not go there."
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You might have copied down a phrase from, "Do you want to be a millionaire?" Which is that your final answer?
Right.
So now you've got a little thing. You in your mind there's something saying, "Well, what's the most?" You're starting off saying, "What's the most ludicrous place that might be?" Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's sort of the process how it works.
Yeah. In the November 22nd issue, the
yes.
cartoon issue, you offer readers a chance to be published in the magazine. There is a cartoon caption contest.
Right. The back page is a caption contest, and if they can look at it, they can enter either by mail or they can go up to our website, and which is cartoonbank.com, or email tune@cartoonbank.com and come up with their caption for it.
Yeah.
And it shows a guy's coming home from work, it looks like. He's got a huge globe on his shoulders. His son is on the porch greeting him, but he's looks like he's yelling back to someone else. Anyway, mm-hmm. And that's the premise for the caption.
Yeah. Have there been a lot of
entries? There's been thousands. Thousands. I get I've got well over 2,000 just on internet responses alone.
Yeah. Wow.
So it's a large thing, and I'm processing them all now. But we will announce a winner in January and publish it.
Can you send more than one idea, or is just?
Well, I told people not to, but that he didn't listen. So
is that
I figured
your final
the heck
answer?
With it. I mean, it's not like we're not the IRS here. You know, we're saying, oh, I'm sorry, you violated the rules of the caption contest, and not only is your latest caption, but every single thing you sent us is disqualified. Nah, go ahead, send it.
Yeah. Is that your final caption?
That's my final answer, yes.
Yeah. Let's take a call. We've got a call
sure.
waiting for us on line 4 in Vermilion County. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Just coincidentally, 3 evenings ago, I picked up again a book that I had been given in 1945 called Cartoon Cavalcade, edited by Thomas Craven.
Yeah, yeah. It had cartoons probably from many different places.
Oh, yes, it did. And in the introduction to the various decades, it said, just before 1925, it is not exaggerating the case to say that the New Yorker, year in and year out, has printed more high-grade graphic humor than any other magazine in America.
Well, I think we can. I'd like to think we can continue to say that over half century.
Now, the very first ones in this book from the New Yorker are in 1925. Alan Dunn and Gardner Ray.
Well, Gardner Ray, sure. They were from the very beginning, and I think Alan Dunn actually. Is the guy who published he was a very topical cartoonist, and he published until his death in 1975, and I think he published the most of any New Yorker cartoonist even to this day. One of the things I've done is I started this company, cartoonbank.com, which is a database of all the New Yorker cartoons, and mm-hmm. you can go up to www.cartoonbank.com and look at them. And now I know, in fact, that Alan Dunn published 1,944 cartoons during his career.
Wow.
Yeah.
You've got to admit you're a little bit impressed.
Well, I'm just so...
Both at what he did and what I can remember.
This is one of the books that I cherish that I've had for those many years. And
Well, go out and buy the new book and cherish that. I mean, this book you have, it's all cherished out.
Well, I used to read the New Yorker in the 1940s, but as far as the prose was concerned, I might just as well have been the old lady from Dubuque, but I always did enjoy the cartoons.
Well, I think you still will. I'm happy you have.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. You know, this book is fabulous. I know that lots of folks I know are going to get it for Christmas. When we were kids growing up, my parents had the 1950 collection.
There's a 1950 collection, there's a 1975 collection, and this is for the year 2000. So I think it makes a nice companion volume, and it is the biggest ever.
Yeah.
You asked me, well, why is it the biggest ever? Well, I put in the most cartoons just so I could say.
Yeah. Well, that the one that my parents had was much loved and pretty much worn out. I mean,
well, one of the things I'm thinking of doing is with our present, publishing company, thinking of reissuing all of them.
Oh, that would be great.
Which I think would be a wonderful idea.
That would be great.
I think people would really like that.
Yeah. 707 cartoons in this edition, the biggest ever collection. And there were over 60,000 to choose from.
Yeah.
So how do you go about picking the cream of the cream?
Well, I did it in a number of ways. One was that because we've created this, database now in which you can actually you know, punch in, we don't have everything online, but we have everything offline. We have about 15,000 cartoons on the internet now. I could actually, you know, punch in a year like 1937 and look at all the cartoons. Where, of course, you theoretically you could do that by going to the... So I did really go through all of them, and my goal was I wasn't creating like an historical tome. Not that there'd be anything wrong with that, but I wanted to pick the ones that were still funny. So I had my own subjective impressions, and I asked, you know, like the editors at the New Yorker, all the senior editors, and David Remnick, who's the editor-in-chief now, what their favorites were. And then what I did, which was unusual, was I went up on the internet, and 50,000 people have registered at cartoonbank.com. I asked them what their favorites were. And I included many of them, and if you go up to our site now and type in 75th anniversary, one word, you'll see the cartoons that people selected as their favorites, 158 of them.
I can hear in my imagination a thundering of keyboards now.
Thunder, I hope so. I hope you don't swamp the site. I'm watching very carefully. I'm going to watch during this whole show whether the book moves on Amazon. And I hope you don't take this as an insult, but if it's not doing well, Celeste, we're going to have to terminate the internet.
Oh, no.
No, I'm only kidding. Oh. That's my job.
Oh.
All right?
Okay. Well, there's a cartoon here in this book.
Yes.
That I'm going to want to tape up in the studio here with me. It's a Charles Saxon.
Yes.
TV talk show.
I know that. I can tell you what it's. TV talk show. The guy is saying, I'm pretty sure the quote is, the guest is saying to the host, "No, Larry, I don't want to talk about it." Something like that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is wonderful, isn't it? Because it's what the cartoonist always does. You take the moment and you just show how absurd everything could be. You sort of ask the what-if question.
Yeah.
You know, you can imagine just the astonishment on the host's face, you know. No, but it's a talk show.
Well, I have a flip side to that. From the point,
you can't shut him up like me.
From the point of view of the host, Larry.
Yeah.
Why no, Ken? I don't want to hear about it.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
I think what the cartoon does is it takes the assumptions of any situation and brings them right to the surface, so you can see the absurdities that might occur. You know, it's analyzing it almost in an anthropological and a sociological way.
Mm.
What are the givens of a talk show? The givens are, you come here, you talk, and you know, and I ask you questions. If you violate that, of course, in real life, you know, it's a disastrous situation, and but somehow that disastrous situation translated onto the page becomes funny.
Yeah. What's Charles Saxon like?
Unfortunately, he's like dead now.
Well,
but he was a very elegant gentleman, of course, a wonderful
yeah.
draftsman, a wonderful artist, very dedicated to what he did, and to certainly a perfectionist in what he did.
Yeah. Another great Peter Arno, unfortunately, no longer with
yes.
us. He died 30 years ago. But his cartoons that are in here, boy, they still work.
Don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're wonderful. And I think that's, to me, in a way, that is a hallmark of a body of New Yorker cartoons, in that I think there's very few things you could, let's take a Peter Arno cartoon in which it's... in the background, there's a plane crashing, a guy is parachuting out, and the guy who's designed the plane is walking away, and he's saying, well, back to the drawing board.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that cartoon was done in the 1930s, and it's still funny. I think there's very few things that you could say over this whole era, and these cartoons span from 1925 to the present, really, that would still hold up like that.
Yeah, yeah. One of my favorites, well, there's so many, I hate to even use the word favorite, but one of my favorite cartoonists is Victoria Roberts.
Oh, she's wonderful.
The couple in the living room, always there.
Always there. There's something sweet about them, but very, very, you know, conflicted. You know, the woman might be saying, I sent your dry cleaning to France.
I have one of hers from a New Yorker calendar that is taped to my refrigerator at home. And it is, she's sitting there in her jammies, and she says to her significant other, who's there with his attaché case and overcoat, "I'm having a pajama day."
That's so adorable.
Yeah.
And someone like Victoria will, besides just being a joke, it's more than a joke. It's really a milieu, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
A slice of existence,
yep.
of these people's existence that you start to understand and, you know, in that way can resonate too.
Yeah, yeah. There's one, well, there are several here in the collection, but there's one early in the book, one featuring an unusual delivery, a man on a bicycle with a loaf of French bread tied to his head.
1-800-BAGUETTE. See, I actually did. You would think that I was actually, minions or assistants that were doing it.
Yeah. In the cartoon issue, you did the Shouts and Murmurs.
Yes, the one-page cartoon course.
Yeah. And that is a reminder of how the drawing and the caption have to come together, and
and there'd be sort of an element of surprise.
Yeah, but also, you know, you point to, if I'm recalling this correctly, you say that, you know, we're on the cusp of a time when words will be gone and just images.
Of course, I poke a little fun at.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't quite believe it, you know, because I made this, like, weird collage just of pictures I took with a digital camera, you know, and I made fun of this guy who actually says stuff like this, Bran Farron. He's, you know, one of these futurists, these Disney Imagineers, they're called. And I heard him speak once at a conference, and frankly, I thought most of it was nonsense. And I really made fun of it. So I make this whole collage, you know, which you know, I think I say something like, you know, don't understand it. Well, you
don't
know,
worry.
Come the millennium, you will, or if not this millennium, certainly the next.
Yeah.
I think images, of course, are used, but we're still human beings. We're not going to be transformed into somehow otherworldly creatures for whom now completely different things are meaningful or funny. It's still going to go back to our ourselves as people and the foibles that we have. I think, you know, one of the things the verities of these cartoons, I think, should be that they're not so ironic. You know what I mean? That they're completely detached from what's going on. I mean, a lot of what goes on in comedy now is this very, very sort of almost strained irony. Even a type of campiness, which is, you know, I'm so bored with it, and if you think this is funny, I think it's funny, but I'm not even sure I think it's funny. What do you think? You know, it's almost a David Letterman attitude towards everything.
Yeah.
And I really think that's the although he can be funny, that's sort of the death of real humor, which is actually saying, you know, one of the things I tried to do in that one-page cartoon course was be funny. Not, you know, to say, okay, I'll try, and I hope I am, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, not protecting yourself from, you know, from humor.
Yeah. There's a cartoon in the collection. I'm just recalling the drawing and the caption now. Forgive me, I can't recall the artist. But getting at this whole, you know, problem of irony in our lives. You know, this woman, this couple coming out of a theater, and she turns to her friend and says, "Well, I thought it was delightful, but, you know, Bob tells me we've just been manipulated."
Right, manipulated. I think it's the William Hamilton cartoon.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. That whole, and many years ago, I think Ed Korn did a cartoon, someone like that, where it's one of Ed Korn's characters, and he's obviously talking to the critic at the theater, and he's saying, "Pray tell, is it good?" And I think that's it. That we in humor often look to other people, in so much of society, to tell us, is this good? Is it funny? When the fact is, in something like humor, we are the judge for ourselves. You know, who else can we really judge for?
Yeah. You know, in 60,000 cartoons, have there ever been clunkers, stinkers?
Oh, absolutely. And we publish them all the time. I'm happy to say we do, which means that we can make mistakes. If you want to protect yourself, it goes back to this question, of safety.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to protect yourself so much, you're so sure that you're never going to publish a bad cartoon, you won't publish a good one either. You won't take the risks.
Yeah.
There's nothing infallible about picking them. But I will say the New Yorker has a process like nobody else has, in that about 1,000 will come in a week. I'll take about 30 or 40 to the art meeting with David Remnick. We'll look at those, me, David Remnick, Rick Hertzberg, another senior editor. We'll pick, you know, maybe 15 or 20. Then they will go to the fact-checking department at the New Yorker and the library to make sure the ideas aren't too similar to ones we've done before. Then they'll go, as I said, to fact-checking to see, is there some sort of illogical inconsistency where it couldn't be? You know, and then they'll go to fact-checking to, in terms of visually, not that the cartoon has to be completely accurate, but they'll want you to draw, you know, if there's a policeman uniform, they want to make sure that you got the badge on the right side. Well, I don't think there's any other process like that.
Yeah. No focus group.
No focus group, absolutely not. And the less focus group, the better, I think, you have. And although I like to have people's opinions, I wanted to know what cartoons were people's favorites, you know, but those people told me over the Internet individually, which is different than a focus group, you know, different than a group of people where you're watching almost the sociodynamics of the group. I'm interested in people's opinions, and then, you know, I'm giving them due weight, but then in the end I'm deciding I think this is funny because, you know, someone has to do it. It's a tough, dirty job. It just happens to be mine.
Pretty nice, tough, dirty
job.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. The artists, now they drop off their cartoons.
Well, I see them in person on Tuesday.
Okay.
From about 10 o'clock to 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I think we're the only place that does that anymore also. One time, like during the 1940s, New York, where a lot of the magazines was a haven for this field. You'd start early in the morning. I mean, I'm told this. It was around the 1940s, and you'd go around to each magazine showing your stuff. Now, in terms of the people doing that, only the New Yorkers left, but I do see people on Tuesday.
Yeah. And
the other people do drop off, of course, or they mail in.
And what are Tuesdays like with all these folks around? In the magazine, at the magazine.
It's fun. A lot of them, of course, my friends.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes they're happy. Sometimes they're unhappy. It's not that easy to come up and be funny, and your material is not always accepted. But it's a band of brothers and sisters. There's not that many people in the world to do this thing, so I have a great deal of affection for all of them.
Are they all New Yorkers?
Oh, well, I mean, they're New Yorkers when they're in New York, but no, of course, they're from everywhere. And most of the people actually in Manhattan aren't from New York anyway.
Yeah. But I wonder, do you get
in fact, I don't think anybody is from any place anymore. I was in Denver, and everyone from Denver was from Chicago.
Yeah.
And then when I was in Chicago, everyone from Chicago was from Detroit. So I just wish everyone would go back to their original spot.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if you have, you know, if you get... I know you get submissions, surely, from Nebraska and Iowa and Minnesota and Illinois.
Oh, from everywhere. And we look at it, you certainly don't have to be from New York in any way to submit to the New Yorker or from, you know, anywhere. You can be orbiting in space as far as I'm concerned. Then you don't have to know anybody and you don't have to know me. And you don't have to have a good personality or you don't have to have a bad personality. You just have to do the stuff that it turns out that we like. That's really all there is to it. There's nothing to figure out. Except it helps if you're persistent and actually do it. The mistake most people make, which really stamps amateur all over them, is that they submit a single cartoon. They think this is, you know, the one idea that's going to end the world.
Need at least 10, you advise.
At least 10. Well, you know, I said in the piece, I said 10. Why 10? I said because 9 out of 10 things in life don't work out. That's why you do 10 things. Do 10.
Are there personality qualities, personality traits at all common to cartoonists?
I think that they are, you know, they are in touch with something childlike in themselves. They never got to be complete, total grown-ups. and maybe it's because they work alone or they freelance. They also, the successful ones have an actual point of view that they're not, that you can't make up. They're not trying to do cartoons for the New Yorker magazine. They're trying to do cartoons for themselves that the New Yorker magazine happens to like.
Mm-hmm. What's Roz Chast like?
Roz Chast actually doesn't exist. She's a composite of many, many different people. It's just a creature we created.
Really?
And I'm revealing that now for the first time. There is no Roz Chast.
You're kidding
me. No, of course there is. Roz Chast is just, this is what everyone wants to hear, is just like her cartoons. She's a charming, small woman, about 5'2", intensely neurotic, very, very sweet, and in her own way, an absolute genius.
Yeah.
In that she invented an entire form. And, no one is a better example than Roz for what I call sort of authentic cartooning, where you're doing the cartoons that you want to do basically for yourself first. And then what's great is, and this is why people have such a bond with it, it turns out they like it too, which means somehow they like your whole sensibility.
Yeah. She's got to be a very sensitive person.
Right. She would say too sensitive.
Too sensitive.
Sensitive to everything, you know.
Yeah.
To driving. Elevators, to everything.
From your cartoon memory bank, can you draw out the big book of parent-child fights?
Well, that has everything. That's in there. That has every single, variant of it.
That's wonderful.
The full page. I mean, that's really a whole skit in itself.
Yeah.
I mean, a whole world, really. And I think when someone like Roz, you have really, to my mind, the perfect amount of writing and drawing. I mean, a lot of pieces, especially written pieces, they can start off funny, but, about halfway through the premise, you get the idea.
Yeah.
You somehow don't want to go the rest of the way.
Yeah.
With Roz, you always want to sort of devour every little tidbit.
Right, right. It's like a big, wonderful novel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In one page.
A big, wonderful
which
comic
makes it
book.
Even better because you don't have to worry about the bookmark.
Yeah. The Big Book of Parent-Child Fights, though. This is a big, big book. It begins with food arguments, page 1, and goes to miscellaneous battles at page 9,505.
Not a real book you should mention, or else people will be going up to Amazon and looking for the Big Book Child Fights, and they will not be seeing it. It's a single page that describes a book in the 75th Anniversary Cartoon Collection.
Yeah. Well, and you could also find it right now at www.cartoonbank.com.
Absolutely. You could find that. And I expect you to register. I'll be looking for your name.
Okay, I will. All right.
I
haven't visited for a while.
I won't. So. That was one of the deals for this interview. When they set it up, they said she will register.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. All right.
You're warned.
I will do that.
Okay.
As soon as I'm off the air. Bob Mankoff is our guest this afternoon. He's the cartoon editor for The New Yorker magazine. It's a tough job, but it's taken. This is The Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Here are the telephone numbers. Do join us if you have a comment or a question. 333-WILL. That's in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else in Illinois or Indiana, call us toll-free at 1-800-222-WILL. 333-9455. 800-222-9455. Do cartoonists look like their cartoons, you think?
Well, after you see both of them, they do. it's more people projecting. Roz looks a little like our cartoon.
Yeah.
Not everybody. George Booth is I wouldn't say he looks really like his cartoons, but I would say, let me put it this way, rather than say that they look like the cartoons, if someone didn't know and you had a picture of the person in their cartoons, could they match them?
Uh-huh.
And I think often they could match the two.
Yeah.
There'd be something about that look or something that would be revealing.
Yeah. Let's talk with some callers.
Okay.
Our next caller this afternoon is on line 1 in Urbana. Hi.
Hi. I just called to say I just realized I've had a grin on my face ever since I tuned in. It's been delightful. Thank
you. That's great. Thank you.
Yes, it's been just lovely. I look forward to...
Well, wipe that grin off.
Oh, well, I'll have to work hard at that.
After that. Where are you actually?
Are
you in your house?
They'd be saying.
Well, then it's safe because, you know, they can just pick you up and pull you off to the side of the road in or banner or whatever.
Exactly.
You have a grin on your face.
Yes, well, I have to grin all I can today since I go back to work tomorrow. But thanks a lot, and I'll look forward to seeing the book.
Okay, great.
Okay, bye-bye.
That's nice.
Yeah, very nice. That's a wonderful book. It's, you know, laughter is the best medicine. You're getting a...
Well, sometimes medicine is the best laughter, and that's a problem.
You're getting a lifetime's medicine chest in this,
yeah,
in this collection.
Yeah, I think it is great. I one of the really good things about these books, and I find the cartoons in general, although, you know, humor to some extent is, you know, based on the element of surprise. You know, you see the picture and the caption, you put it together, and you laugh. But somehow, even afterwards, you keep wanting to look at these cartoons.
Yep.
They give you that sort of just wonderful pleasure because, I don't know, they remind you of something. I mean, you know, there's and so many of the cartoons are sort of almost prescient. There's a Sam Gross cartoon in this book that was done in the 70s, which makes fun of all the self-help thing, which now is going on, you know, to beat the band. And it's a guy in bed, and he's... hasn't gotten up yet, and the book he's reading is How to Get Up and Get Dressed.
Let's talk with another caller.
Sure.
On line two, a caller in Champaign. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
It's nice to speak with you, Mr. Mankoff.
Nice to speak with you.
My name is Shauna, and I started reading New Yorker cartoons when I was a wee little girl, probably about old enough to recognize the cartoons but not to print. My grandfather used to subscribe forever. And then also eventuated to doctor's offices, and now, some 48 years later, my mom keeps in touch by sending me New Yorker cartoons. And I had to mention my favorite all-time New Yorker cartoon, and unfortunately I can't remember the artist, but there's a picture of a gentleman seated naked from the waist up on an examining table, with a small creature on his left shoulder wearing a trench coat.
That's a suspicious...
looking mole on your shoulder.
Is that the one?
That's it.
See, I am the cartoonist. This is like,
yes.
Maybe Regis Philbin could have a show where I answer the questions. I'd be cleaning up. You know, that's great to, you know, it's really great to hear it. I think that the, you know, people often say about the New Yorker cartoons, a little bit suggested even here, well, they have to be from New York, and it's obvious that you don't. You simply, I think, have to have a sense of humor, and frankly, you know what? Be somewhat intelligent.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe that's taboo to say, but you have to be. But a lot of the cartoons have to do with the thinking. You know, you have to get certain allusions or references,
okay.
and we make no apologies for that. There are an awful lot of smart people out
there.
Well,
I'm a physician myself now, and I'm recovering from surgery. And my mom just sent me a card, and it is one that.
Well,
shows
we have a lot. We have a lot of doctor jokes in there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're wonderful. And this one shows a woman standing in a graveyard looking at an RIP tomb. It says, good news, hon, your doctor now has the right to recommend treatment.
That's right. That's a Mick Stevens cartoon. We just ran that.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, one of the things also we do try to make, you know, some of them are just for jokes, especially about medicine. Often it really is, it really does make some sort of point.
It does.
And sometimes I think the point made, you know, our site, cartoonbank.com, actually licenses the cartoons to newsletters, medical newsletters, advertisements. Often humor can make a point more quickly, more trenchantly, and really says all that has to be said about that subject.
Exactly.
One of the things I get about cartoons is that, well, sometimes it's true, absolutely, people don't like every one of them, but they're never bored.
Yes. I have one quick question.
Sure.
On George Booth. Does he have cats?
George has many cats and many dogs. Sometimes George can actually be found amid all the dogs and cats. Other times he can never be located.
I had thought by looking at his cats and dogs that certainly this must be a cat and dog owner.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, sir.
Well, thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
For the call this afternoon. Our next caller this afternoon is on line three. Another caller in Champaign. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. You?
I'm fine. I just wanted to make an observation about the nature of, this is called gag cartooning.
Sure.
And you said early on in the show that you liked telling cartoons, which is actually kind of rubs me the wrong way because cartoons really shouldn't be told. Mm.
Well, then we're
seen.
Just going to shut up. We're not going to say one, but sometimes they have to be.
Well, I'm sure that that's true, but the essential character of a cartoon is that there's a picture which constitutes a kind of a puzzle by itself, and then there's a caption which doesn't make much sense either. And if you put the two together,
well,
they make
I think
sense.
You're exactly right. In the Peter Arno cartoon, in which the plane is crashing in the background,
that's it, right?
And he's walking away. Neither one. He's saying, "Well, back to the drawing board."
Right.
Neither one of these things is funny. I mean, I of course could not agree more.
Yeah, that's.
And after all, I am the cartoon editor, so I should know that. Although I was writing down everything you said, just in case.
I've thought of gag cartoons as sort of the haiku of cartooning.
Well, I think you're right. They compress it to the when I'm actually writing a joke, I wanted it to be a surprise. I want you not to be able to get ahead of it. So let's say a line where there's a businessman, he's at a boardroom and a table, and I'm sorry I have to tell this, although I can draw it and send it to you as well. And he's saying about something. He said, you know, well, the upside potential is tremendous, but the downside is jail.
Yes.
Well, you see what I mean?
Yes,
it falls off a cliff.
Yes, well, you can...
And when you're talking about a gag cartoon, it actually refers sort of to the gag reflex that type of cartoon produces, where it falls right off. And it really is its own art form, and you'd be surprised how hard it is to do it. And I say that because I know a lot of people in different comedy fields. I was just did a little TV show with Al Franken and someone else on the discussion of humor in the millennium. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these guys will come up to you with cartoon ideas, and you know what? They're
they
not
aren't.
Good. And
they're
these
good.
Are professional comedy writers.
Right, yeah. I have been noticing, perhaps I should preface this by saying, unfortunately, in the New Yorker in the last few years that... there are an awful lot of cartoons that you don't need the picture in order to understand the joke.
Well, I'm trying to change that.
Good.
I agree.
One issue.
And I became cartoon editor in 1997, and basically the truth is I'm along with your philosophy.
Yeah, good.
Let me put it this way. If the gag is so great, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Every part of humor, whatever rule you have, should be violated. In certain instances.
Yeah.
When it's just so great. But as a general rule, I agree. But, you know, sometimes you have a line that's so good, and it makes a point that you have to make on this week. And I understand what you're saying. It's two people at a cocktail party, and they could be saying anything.
Anything. In fact...
But, you know, the other thing is that an editor in a magazine exists in the real world.
Yeah.
So sometimes you're down to the deadline. You want that cartoon about the World Trade Organization. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You've got a number of lines, and you go with the best you can. But, you know, I agree, and I think you should start your own cartoon magazine because you have all the principles down pat. Of course, it only happens to be one principle,
but I
tried
that
absolutely down.
With a recent issue of The New Yorker, I simply moved the captions from one cartoon to the next available.
Oh, you're not allowed to do that. That's a violation.
Don't you ever come
to New York City, Giuliani will arrest you for that.
I see.
He's very strict about moving the I don't believe you could move all the
Not all of them, but there were an awful lot of them in one particular issue. Before I quit this, I might want to...
Maybe you want to rein some effusive praise as well.
Yeah, well, effusive
praise. Because you only got a minute.
Yeah, okay, well...
A nice parting shot.
Let me mention that there are a couple books out about New Yorker cartoonists, the essential George Booth and the essential Charles Barsotti, which
both by Lee Lorenz.
Who is your predecessor.
Yes, absolutely. Wonderful cartoonists themselves, and those books are great. But, of course, I prefer you buy the book.
Yeah.
We're plugging now. Buy all three. You can't go wrong.
We're out of time.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, it is too bad.
I had a great time, Celeste.
So did I.
As always.
And I hope...
Well, and we'll try to come up with a new book for next year so we can do this.
I hope sales skyrocket so that You know,
well, I'm sure
so
they
that
will.
You'll be jumping at the chance to join us again.
I'm champing now. I'm champing at that metaphorical bit even as we speak.
Okay. Take care.
Okay, Beth?
All right.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bob Mankoff, our guest this afternoon. He is the cartoon editor for The New Yorker. He is also the editor of The New Yorker 75th Anniversary Cartoon Collection, now in bookstores. Also, he is the creator and the president, I think I have that correct, of www.cartoonbank.com.